a look at new treatments for lung cancer, the importance of eye exams, and we'll delve into new ways we train for CPR in the future with the American Heart Association's Resuscitation Quality Improvement Program. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's the Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show, our podcast for nurses by nurses. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to take this opportunity to, as always, say thanks for checking out the show this week. First up in this week's episode, we're going to be looking at the American Heart Association's groundbreaking Resuscitation Quality Improvement Training Program, or RQI. Then we're going to look at a special interview segment on lung cancer and the importance of getting examined and checked out, and of course some new treatments that are available there. So we'll have that and more coming up later on in this episode, coming up just in a bit. Before we get to the news and everything else, though, I do want to make sure that you follow up on all of the information from this and all of our episodes, and you can do that by heading over to nursingshow.com. Check out the links in each episode's show notes over there. You can also find other articles and links to other things, like our free Nursing Show mobile app, so you can get that and download it into your mobile devices. Also, make sure you're following up so you know what I'm talking about in the show each week and how it applies using your own nursing scope of practice. If you have a question, you want to get back in touch with me or a comment or anything, just drop me an email. Send those emails in to me here to nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from you, and I make sure I respond back to all the emails that come in. So send me things. You can send me links to news items you want me to take a look at, maybe an interview suggestion with you or somebody you know. Whatever the case may be, I will respond to you, so keep those emails coming. Also, a special thank you to Physiocontrol for being my overall sponsor for this episode, as well as the American Heart Association for their support and partnership in these last few months of 2016. That's it. I'll have some more contact information coming up later on in this episode, but let's go ahead and get on into this week's Nursing Show episode coming right up. This week's special news item is brought to us through a special partnership with the American Heart Association. I interview ER Doc Michael Kurtz about the importance of doing the research that shows why we need to change the way we train people for CPR in our facilities. Now, this is a look at the AHA's RQI program. It's a continuous ongoing CPR training on rotating 90-day cycles. The research says that this leads to better outcomes and reduced training costs. Check it out. Michael, I want to welcome you to the show, and thank you very much for making some time out of your busy schedule to join us and share with us some information about this exciting new program that the American Heart Association has put together.
Jamie, thank you very much. It's my pleasure to chat with you and your listeners and serve the American Heart Association.
So let's talk a little bit about that. First off, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background and who you are.
My name is Michael Kurtz. I'm an associate professor at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and a physician scientist here in the Department of Emergency Medicine. I am ER trained with fellowship training in emergent cardiology. I come to this from very humble beginnings. I started as a medic, an EMT, and then a medic in 96 in Charlottesville, Virginia. Was on the street until I graduated from medical school in 03, and then largely chose my residency at the University of Chicago to train based on the idea that it was the best one I could get into, and they would let me fly as a flight physician. So I did scene response for 2 years. Since then, I've done a number of things in emergency medicine. Some of the most proud moments, I was medical director for Henrico County for a period of 5 years before coming here to UAB. Henrico is a county just north of Richmond, Virginia, population of, I think, 350,000. We had 500 personnel, 60 units on the street. It was a big gig that I remember my time there very fondly.
Excellent. So we're talking about the resuscitation quality improvement program that the American Heart Association has. And one of the things that we're most excited about that I heard about was that there was some research to back up the fact that there is some this is a better way to train and renew training in our CPR technique.
Yeah, so I think the real value here in the RQI program is that it changes the foundational paradigm upon which we've all been trained in how to do BLS or CPR. The old paradigm was you sat through a class and you got renewed in every 2 years. In between, if you passed the class, in between we kind of just hoped that you retain your skills. And we know from scientific literature that is indeed not the case, that somewhere around 90 days, your skill, if you have not performed CPR, your skill, psychomotor skill set falls off dramatically. That's the beauty of the RQI system. It combats that loss of proficiency that we would normally get in the interval between training.
So what did you see in the facility where you are in Alabama? There was a definite improvement in the quality of things like compression fraction and other markers we can track.
Yeah, so with the RQI system, so we implemented it in my emergency department at UAB. It's UAB is the Death Star of modern medicine. There's 1,100 beds. 250 ICU beds. My ED sees an annual volume of 85,000. And so I have 150 staff nurses that staff my emergency department. We did baseline measures of their CPR proficiency using the MINI criteria for CPR quality. That's from the AHA scientific statement in 2013. And then put them through RQI for a year and measured their proficiency at the end. And we saw definite improvements in simulated chest compression fraction, adequate recoil, depth. Essentially, all the numbers that you wanted to go up went up. All the numbers that you wanted to go down, like overventilation or tidal volume of ventilation, went down. So a clear improvement over a year ago.
So how do facilities take those kind of numbers, and can we translate those numbers into lives saved? Is that something that is even possible, or do we just have to kind of extrapolate that if we improve this, we know that we get a higher survival rate?
Right. So the trick here is what you really want to see as an outcome measure is lives saved or survival or even like ROSC, right? Return of spontaneous circulation. And the reality is, even as large as my department is, where we probably see an arrest a day in our department, it's not enough because of the statistics involved, there's not a volume there at one site in order to give the outcome measures that we really want, survival, ROSC, et cetera. And so what we have to rely upon is kind of proxy values that we know translate into survival. And so there is good evidence that higher chest compression fraction, adequate depth, et cetera, translates into survival, and we demonstrated those quality metrics.
One other thing, as we kind of wrap this up, there is a cost associated with this. You have to have the type of mannequin station that can actually track these things, that can actually be that interactive training scenario station for your staff so they can do the regular training every 90 days. But that cost can be recouped because of the additional costs with staffing, the additional costs with paying for additional training. And you really talked about that a little bit in the case study I saw.
Yeah, so that's all true. That the device, the RQI system, is essentially a computerized CPR trainer on a cart. And so it's mobile. And yes, there is a licensing fee involved from the American Heart Association. And you have to lease the capital in this instance. And in the interest of full disclosure, for your listeners, ours is provided after the first year. Ours is provided to the university at no cost as part of a research grant agreement. However, when we went back and looked at our numbers, and even before the research agreement, what we found is our return on investment was something nearing fourfold when we looked at the relative cost of the program, the RQI program, in relation to exactly what you describe, which is the infrastructure required to maintain proficiency among your staff. A lot of times, these costs just get absorbed throughout the institution in various places. But you are very correct to highlight that it is not just, for example, the cost of the card. It is also the cost for that staff member's time, because inevitably these are paid hours outside of your department. It is the cost to pay trainers or teachers. You need a medical director for these classes. You need equipment to run these classes, etc. All of these costs add up very quickly, and the RQI program, in contrast, is kind of a one-stop shop that is has a very high value ratio when you look at the bottom dollar.
And on top of that, you saw really a great change in the way people approach CPR in your facility. That there was you said there was a culture change in the article I read?
Yeah, so I think in addition to all of the hard numbers, like I'm a scientist, right? So I really like hard numbers and I like to talk about hard numbers. But in addition to the hard numbers that are that clearly demonstrated as a result of this research, we also have seen a culture change in our department. The staff now competes against each other to make sure that their numbers are higher than their friends. And what is really done is empower the nursing staff to take responsibility for the resuscitation. And so we've seen a real paradigm shift. For example, the nursing staff no longer asks if the physician staff during resuscitation wants hands on chest or CPR going. The nursing staff is just empowered to do CPR until someone tells them to stop. And so the default is quality CPR. And to that end, that intangible focus on quality resuscitation from the nursing staff, that's the intangible benefit from this program that's really gold. I can't pay for that. I can't I can't engage that through policy of some variety. That has to come from within, from the culture, and that's really what's happened in our department.
Next up in the episode is a special interview with oncologist Dr. Alexander Drillin and also a lung cancer survivor, Juanita Segura. The two talk about the risk factors for lung cancer and also what we may not be thinking about and how we can continue to support research and awareness for lung cancer and support our lung cancer patients along the way. Here it is.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hello.
Hi, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you could just start off by telling me a little bit about, so my readers know, what you do and your experience.
Of course. My name is Alexander Drillin, and I'm a medical oncologist who focuses on developing new therapies for lung cancer patients, and I work at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
And I'm Juanita Segura. I am a lung cancer survivor and an advocate, mother of five, and I own my very own CrossFit gym.
Very cool. So if you could just tell me, Doctor, how lung cancer just affects different people and what people should be aware of.
There are symptoms that are common in lung cancer patients, like cough, shortness of breath and wheezing. But it's important to point out that up to half of patients who are diagnosed with lung cancer may not have any symptoms at all. So if you in particular have a substantial risk factor or a history of smoking, for example, talk to your doctor about whether or not screening is appropriate for you.
Are there any other risk factors that people should be aware of?
There are. You know, the number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 risk factors are smoking. And there are other environmental agents that can contribute to the development of lung cancer, although the relative risk for things like asbestos and other environmental chemicals is much lower compared to people that have an active history of smoking. One thing that I should point out also is that while we've mentioned smoking a whole lot, is that up to 10 to 15% of patients who are diagnosed with lung cancer never smoked before. And so we really should get away from the stigma that lung cancer is only a smoker's disease.
Interesting. How common is it among men and women?
Lung cancer can affect men and women equally, and there are about 200,000 cases that are diagnosed in the U.S. each year. Sadly, up to 160,000 of those cases pass away from their disease. And I think we should really do a good job of trying to get the word out there about what this diagnosis means and what treatments are available, and raise awareness on this month especially, which is Lung Cancer Awareness Month.
Absolutely. And Juanita, can you tell us a little bit about just your experience and why you think it's important for people to get tested?
Yes. I was diagnosed almost 2 years ago, November 20th of 2014. I started off wheezing and then a cough that progressed and got worse. By November, I ended up in the ER, and they did x-ray and blood work, everything under the sun, everything kept coming back negative. So finally they did a CT scan and they showed an enlarged lymph nodes on the right side. And then I got it tested the following day. They did a bronchoscopy and it came back that I was non-small cell stage 3B lung cancer. And that was like the worst day, the worst news of my life, especially, you know, my husband was there, thank God, but he broke down. I couldn't even cry. I was in just shock. And I remember looking at my doctor and asking him or telling him, I don't smoke. And he told me, you have the non-smokers. I didn't even know there was a non-smokers, because the stigma, like Doc said, is you smoke, you get lung cancer. And then they look at you and they say, well, you deserve it because no one told you to smoke. That's not true. And that's not the case. I never smoked. You know, that we got to get away from that stigma. The worst part was telling my 5 children that mom might not make it. Mom might not be there for weddings or graduations or soccer games. You know, and I cry every time I share the story all over the place because, you know, my kids are my life. I gave birth to them. And for them to grow up without a mom, it was the hardest thing to tell them. To tell my now 15-year-old that I won't be on those bleachers screaming when you make a goal. You know, tell my daughters, I won't see you walk down that aisle. Tell my husband, and it's not funny, but it's funny, find another wife and spend the rest of your life happy, you know. But I'm a fighter. And because of that, I am an advocate now. I go around and I tell people, if it's Facebook, Instagram, my neighbor, my own CrossFit box, everywhere I go, people I'm talking to the grocery store, I let them know about lung cancer. And I, you know, someone that's just got diagnosed, a lot of them, they call me, they come to me, and I'll tell them what's important is genomic testing. You know, do your research, especially on the website for Lung Cancer Foundation of America, which is lcfamerica.org. There's a lot of information out there for lung cancer, clinical trials, treatments, and stuff like that. So, you know, I tell them, get educated, do your homework, and then ask questions. But the most important thing is genomic testing. And like I said, there's treatments for that, for certain type of lung cancer. I just give them lots of hope. I inspire them. I share my story all over the place. And I let them know I'm still here. I wasn't supposed to be here. I'm here. And I'm an entrepreneur. I own my own CrossFit. So if I could do it, you could do it too. It's just stay positive, stay faithful. I stay very, very strong in the Word of God. Like I said, I'm just here educating and trying to help as many people as I can. And one thing that we're doing that Lung Cancer Foundation of America is doing is a 30-day 30 ways, and that is just pick a day, like for example today, and get facts on their website and post it, hashtag little things LCFA, and just educate not only yourself, but your family, your friends, your coworkers, your neighbors, everyone that follows you or friends on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, and let them know about lung cancer, that it's not a smoker disease anymore. Anyone could get lung cancer. We all have lungs.
Me too. That's so inspiring. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
Is there any other place where people can get more information or resources that you both would suggest?
Well, I think that capitalizing on the 30 Days, 30 Ways program, if you're on social media, look up the hashtag LittleThingsLCFA. And in addition, also share your own story. Share what you think is the little thing today that helps remind you that life is a beautiful thing, like focusing on your breathing, focusing on centering yourself. And as Juanita mentioned, the Lung Cancer Foundation America website, which is lcfamerica.org.
Very cool. Well, thank you both for your time.
Well, thank you, Vanessa.
This was wonderful.
Yeah,
thanks.
Have a great afternoon.
You too.
That's going to close out this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. Make sure you follow up, though, on all of the information you picked up in this episode. Head over to nursingshow.com and check out the episode show notes. There's a link right there at the top of the page. In there are listings for all of the episodes of The Nursing Show. From the most recent one at the top, you can scroll down and go all the way back to the very first episode. But I want you to get the full information there with links to other resources so that you understand how to apply what you hear on the show to your own nursing practice or studies. If you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email. You can send that in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond back to every email that comes in, and I want to hear from you. So send me your comments, your questions, suggestions, news links. Help support the Nursing Show community with your input. You can also get the Nursing Show email newsletter. There's a link and form right on the right-hand side of the Nursing Show site. So fill out that short form and we'll send you the links to each episode's show notes directly to your email inbox each week. You can also connect with me on social media sites. I'm available there under the handle PodMedic. So you can find me there under twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic. So friend or follow me. You can also become a member of the community over on Facebook by liking the Nursing Show Facebook page at facebook.com/nursingshow. Click the like button there and join the conversation on that page. I post other nursing and healthcare articles and pictures on the Nursing Show site throughout the course of each week and over at the Nursing Show page, so check it all out. That's it for me. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. I'll be back with more episodes here of The Nursing Show. Remember, it comes out every Friday for you, so you can wrap up your nursing week. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show.